You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Diplomatic relations between the U.S. and Russia have gone through some extreme highs and lows since the breakup of the Soviet Union 22 years ago, but they may have hit their lowest point yet late last week when Russia invaded Ukraine's Crimea Peninsula. As U.S. officials debate what the response should be, Russian officials await the results of this coming Sunday's referendum on whether the people of Crimea want to remain part of Ukraine or rejoin Russia. Joining us now is Angela Stent, a leading authority in post-Soviet Russia and the author of The Limits of Partnership, in which she looks at how the U.S. and Russia have managed to reach agreements over the past two decades on nuclear proliferation, arms control, and terrorism, even as the gap between their interests and values has left them divided on other major issues. Dr. Stent is a former State Department National Intelligence Officer for Russia, and she now directs the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at the Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. Her book is published by Princeton University Press. I'm very pleased that it brings her to our show today. Hello.
Hello. I'm delighted to be on your show.
I imagine your phone has been ringing off the hook for the past few days.
It's been a very busy few weeks. All of us with this expertise, some of us acquired during the Soviet period, and then now in the Russian period, we've all been called, summoned to appear on various shows trying to explain the intricacies of the Ukrainian-Russian relationship and the status of Crimea.
Aren't scholars in this area, especially those who've also studied diplomatic relations between the U.S. and post-Soviet Russia, few and far between nowadays?
Yes, there aren't too many of us left anymore, alas, because what happened was, you know, during the Cold War years, there was a lot of funding to train people in the Soviet politics to understand the Russian system. And then once the Cold War was over, the Soviet Union collapsed, I think people thought, well, you know, we don't have an enemy anymore there, and we don't need to invest these resources. So you really have a missing generation. There are some younger scholars, but there are not enough of them. There should be more. And looking into the future looks even bleaker in this country unless we realize this is a priority and start investing our resources in it.
On the other hand, could you have imagined a better time for the release of this book?
I sincerely couldn't, and of course people are joking that I must have had some in the Kremlin telling them this was the time to act. So for me, it was just lucky that it came out at a time, well, actually just before the Sochi Olympics, and then everyone thought when the Sochi Olympics were over, then probably the focus on Russia would die down a little bit, and then what did we have? We had the crisis in Ukraine.
Vladimir Putin is a mystery to many in the West, but I understand you've had dinner with him on a number of occasions, and that you even visited his home and met his dog?
This is true. So,
under what circumstances?
Well, this is, I'm part of a group, and for the past 10 years, this has been a project of the now defunct RIA Novosti news agency. It's been taken over by another one, to bring a group of foreign experts to Russia every year, take them to a different part of Russia, so they see this all the different parts of this vast and very interesting country. And then at the end, we meet with President Putin. We met with him also when he was prime minister. Most of the time, we've met with him in Moscow, but a couple of times, we were, in fact, taken to Sochi. And the first time we went to Sochi was in 2007, just after Russia had gotten the Olympic Games. And we went to this beautiful mansion, government house, overlooking the Black Sea. And, in fact, we did meet his dog, Connie, who's a big black Labrador. So that, in a way, humanized the whole thing.
Well, he often wears a stern expression. Even during the Winter Olympics, he kept his expression very neutral. Did he relax or smile during any of the dinners you attended? I assume he didn't take off his shirt.
No. He kept on a suit. He doesn't really smile very much. He is a very serious person. He always exudes self-confidence. He knows lots of facts and figures. He never asks any of his assistants to give him information. There are occasional flashes of humor. There's also sometimes occasional flashes of sarcasm. But he's really not someone to kind of smile and joke around, at least in a gathering like that.
Well, in 2001, George Bush said, "I looked the man in the eye. I found him to be very straightforward and trustworthy. We had a very good dialogue. I was able to get a sense of his soul, a man deeply committed to his country and the best interests of his country."
He He did. And I think on that first occasion, apparently the chemistry between the two leaders was very good. If you also read Condoleezza Rice's memoirs, she will say that this is not a question that anyone had prepared President Bush for. The question, I believe, was, you know, do you trust him?
Well, you've looked him in the eye. Do you trust him?
I'm not sure that that's the right question, I would say. I mean, I think what I can say from these meetings with him is what one gets is a sense of what he wants, in this case, outside observers to hear, the image of himself that he wants to put forward, and his explanation for things. And sometimes those explanations are at variance with our understanding of facts. I think we got a hint from that the other day when they leaked in the New York Times that Chancellor Merkel had apparently said to President Obama that she didn't know whether he was in full command of the facts. But I think the question of trust is probably the wrong one, just because you can't get those insights into a leader like that.
Now, although you didn't write about the current situation in Ukraine, you write a lot about Ukraine. Let's begin about talking about what's happening now. Arseniy P. Yatsenyuk, who's been serving as Ukraine's interim prime minister since its more pro-Russian government collapsed last month, met yesterday with President Obama. He's scheduled to be in New York today to address the UN. Has he given any indication of what he'll be asking for?
Well, I think he needs two things. One of them is clearly economic assistance. That's probably, I mean, the United Nations can't give him that, but he certainly asked that from the U.S. government because the Ukrainian economy is really in a free fall, and it's going to default if it doesn't get, assistance from the United States and other international bodies. I mean, I think what he would like from the United Nations is a recognition that what Russia has done is illegal. But if there were a vote in the Security Council, clearly he would never get that because Russia can veto it. But I think in general, he would appeal probably for support for Ukraine's territorial integrity and the legitimacy of the agreement that was signed 20 years ago by Russia, by the U.S., by the Brits, and by Ukraine, whereby Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons. It was then the third largest nuclear state in the world after Russia and the United States. It gave them up in return for a guarantee of its territorial integrity and its sovereignty. I'm sure he would like the United Nations to ratify that, to agree with that, to make sure that they would still support Ukraine. He will clearly present Ukraine's point of view. So it's more moral political support, but it's hard in the United Nations because of Russia's role in the Security Council.
Russia did sign that treaty as well. And last December, in his State of the Nation address, Putin said, "I hope that all political sides can successfully reach an agreement in the interests of the Ukrainian people." What should we read into that?
Well, I think that he, at that point, Russia looked as if when he made that speech, as if Russia had really succeeded in persuading the then President Yanukovych not to sign an agreement with the European Union, but instead to take money, assistance, $15 billion from Russia, and look more toward Russia. And so under those circumstances, and there were, of course, still hundreds of thousands of people camped out in the Maidan Square then, this was an appeal to them maybe to step down to accept it, because at that point Russia looked as if it had the winning hand. But the situation's changed now, obviously. Once you had the fall of the government, Yanukovych fleeing under circumstances that we don't completely understand, just a day after an agreement was signed on February 21st between Yanukovych, between Mr. Yatsenyuk, and between the three visiting European Union foreign ministers and then also a Russian representative, they thought they'd agreed to hold early elections and it was all worked out. And then, of course, he fled and we know what happened. The Russians then took over Crimea. So I think we're now under circumstances where you're not hearing those kind of words from Mr. Putin anymore and you're hearing this very, very sharp rhetoric.
Well, in that same State of the Nation address, he also claimed that Russia is morally superior to the West. He was referring, I think, to its policy regarding homosexuals. But I get the sense that he does feel that Russia is morally superior.
Yes. I mean, in September, when our group went and met with him, and this time out in a beautiful place outside of some way from St. Petersburg, where he has a home and where there's a beautiful hotel. It's an old, actually, Stalin had a Dutch, a country home there, too. And we met with Mr. Putin, and he explicitly said, you know, Western Christianity has lost its way. It's immoral. It's satanic because of issues like LGBT rights and also multiculturalism. And we, the Russians and the Russian Orthodox Church, we're the true harbingers of Christianity, of traditional values, traditional family values. And he also then made an appeal to, there were some Islamic clerics there and Islamic participants in this conference, you know, and these are the same as Islamic values, which is a very shrewd message in a country where there are a lot of tensions between the Russians and the Islamic population. But it's really saying that Russia represents a better alternative to the West. And I remember seeing Mr. Putin on one of the Sunday talk shows just before the Sochi Games opened, saying the same thing, saying 70 countries in the world have legislation restricting LGBT rights. You know, we're no different from the rest of them. And again, we are sort of putting Russia forward as the leader of this conservative international movement, which is quite ironic for someone who used to be a KGB agent.
My guest is Angela E. Stent. Her book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century. As a KGB agent, of course, he was working for atheist Soviet Union. It's kind of odd to hear him citing religion. But do you think that he was backed into a corner when President Viktor Yanukovych fled? Russia maintains an important naval base in Crimea. Some people are saying he had a legitimate concern that Russia would lose access to the base if Ukraine leaned too far to the west.
I think in the beginning there may have been that concern. I mean, when all these tumultuous things happened, I guess February 22nd, February 23rd, and President Yanukovych fled, there were some people in the new interim government or surrounding the new interim government who said things like, well, we may have to revisit all these issues. Russia had signed a basing agreement, a new one with Ukraine, whereby it has the base until 2042. So I think there could have been a concern there that issue might be revisited. And I think the other thing that was quite provocative, seemed to be in Moscow as quite provocative, was that the new group in the Ukrainian Parliament passed a law degrading the Russian language because it had been elevated to being equal with the Ukrainian language. So those two things, I think, were seen as a provocation. And so you could say this was a preemptive move. But, of course, no one was actually talking about reviewing that basing agreement. And, in fact, the Ukrainians have needed the money that the Russians have paid them to lease the base, given their own economic problems.
Although, and that law has been reversed. Although it can be seen as a reason people in Crimea might be uncomfortable with the new Ukrainian government, especially since, as Russian propaganda is arguing, the new leaders in Kiev include right-wing ultranationalists from the Svoboda Party who were responsible for that law. There's even further far-right party called the Right Sector that were major players in the Maidan protests that led Yanukovych to flee.
Yeah, I mean, as always, these situations are very complicated. Yes, there were and are in the Maidan groups that are far-right nationalist that sympathize with groups that in the past were pro-fascist and, you know, one of the heroes, you know, even fought with the Nazis when they invaded the Soviet Union. So those groups are there, but they are a minority. And I think what you've had from the Kremlin and then echoed in places like Crimea and eastern Ukraine is a huge exaggeration of their relative strength. And to describe, you know, the current interim government as, you know, fascist and terrorists and anti-Semites, it's really not in accord with reality. I mean, the Prime Minister, Mr. Yatsenyuk, the acting president, they all come from the party that's allied with Yulia Tymoshenko, the former Prime Minister who was then jailed, has now been released from jail. And they're, you know, quite a centrist party. I mean, they don't include any of these nationalists. There are a couple of people from Svoboda who have cabinet positions in this new interim government. government. And there is someone who's running, who's going to run for president in May, who's an extreme nationalist, but he's not going to win. I mean, the polls show that it'll be, again, someone from this centrist constellation that will win. So I think you have to separate fact from fiction. I think the most stunning thing is if you look at the posters that are up in Crimea in advance of the vote on Sunday, it basically says in Russian, this is your choice. And on one side, you have the red, white, and blue Russian flag. And on the other side, you have a map of Ukraine in red with a swastika on it. So people are being told you're either choosing the Nazis or Russia. And this is, of course, nonsense, because that's not the case.
Well, the Crimea has a majority Russian-speaking population, but it has a large minority that is not. And they are talking about boycotting the referendum. So that almost guarantees that the referendum will be for annexation with Russia.
Right. I think that's good. So the about 60% of the population are Russian. Then about 25% are Ukrainian, and those people don't want to join Russia. And then you have a minority. It's about 12, 13% of the Crimean Tatars. Now, these are an indigenous Muslim group. They've lived there for centuries. They were deported by Stalin in 1944 to Central Asia, accused of collaboration with the Nazis. They slowly moved back, and they have their own language. They have their own little regional assembly. They do not want to join Russia. And so they've certainly talked about boycotting it. Turkey has already offered to them, you know, if you don't want to stay there, you can come and live in Turkey. Russia has now sent Tatars from from the part of the Russian Federation itself there to try and assuage their fears. But they probably will boycott it. But nevertheless, you know, I'm sure a majority of people on Sunday are going to vote for joining Russia, for annexation by Russia.
My guest is Angela E. Stent. She's a professor of government and foreign service and director of the Center for Eurasian, Russian, and East European Studies at Georgetown University. She served in the U.S. Department of State and the National Intelligence Council and has written a number of books, including Russia and Germany, Reborn, Unification, The Soviet Collapse, and The New Europe. Her most recent, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, published by Princeton University Press. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Angela E. Stent, S-T-E-N-T. Her latest book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, published by Princeton University Press. You tell a story about a conversation Putin had with George W. Bush at a NATO summit in 2008, in which he told him, Ukraine is not even a country. Even then, did Putin believe the Crimean Peninsula rightly belonged to Russia, even though it had been given to Ukraine, I guess, by Nikita Khrushchev in 1954?
Well, he certainly did make that remark that Ukraine wasn't a country. And I'm sure that most Russians have had great difficulty accepting that Ukraine is an independent nation, given the fact that, you know, the Russian state was born 1,000 years ago in Kiev. And, you know, the Russians consider the Ukrainians really as their brothers. Sometimes they say younger brothers. And I'm sure most of them, most Russians have never really accepted the fact that Crimea is Ukrainian. Indeed, it was part of Russia for centuries, and it was really only this whim of Khrushchev. It was a sort of historical accident. But the problem is, if you look at the post-Cold War settlement, and you look at a number of countries in the post-Soviet space, these were Union republics of the Soviet Union. Their borders were largely arbitrarily drawn up by Joseph Stalin, who wanted to mix and match the different ethnic groups so no one could have a majority or maybe even challenge the center in Moscow. And so, unfortunately, you know, you're dealing, and we've seen this in the Balkans too, you're dealing with borders that were may have been arbitrarily drawn up. But at what point do you say you have to accept them and move forward? But I'm sure that for most Russians, it's been very difficult to accept that Crimea is in fact part of Ukraine.
An article in today's New York Times reports that Ukraine's president has expressed an openness to giving Crimea more autonomy. Do you think that might lead Putin to reconsider?
Well, right now, I would be very skeptical that he's going to reconsider, you know, what's happening in Crimea. I mean, for me, it looks like it's a fait accompli. They'll have a vote on Sunday. They'll vote to join Russia. How that will actually happen, you know, is not clear. But I think the idea that you could still have Crimea be part of the Ukrainian state, but with more autonomy, because it already has quite a lot of autonomy anyway. It's got much more autonomy than any other part of Ukraine has. I would find it very difficult to believe that Putin will walk back from that, because I think this seems to have been a very well-planned maneuver. I mean, there obviously were plans on the drawing board to do something like this. They decided to do them, I guess, after Yanukovych fled. And with such a huge military presence there, and with such intimidation of anyone who's challenging this, I don't know what it would take to get Russia to walk back from this.
As you've explained in your book, one of Putin's goals since coming to power in 2000 has been to prevent NATO or the EU from encroaching any further east into post-Soviet space. How many former communist countries are now members of the EU, and how many others have suggested that they would like to join it?
Well, all of Central Europe and the three Baltic states are members of the European Union, and the same goes, in their case, for NATO. Now, I mean, the last enlargement of NATO, which took place and the EU in 2004, again, the Baltic states were included, and Putin, as I describe in my book, very, you know, reluctantly accepted that. But the Baltic states were always regarded as somewhat different from the rest of the former Soviet Union because, you know, they only joined the Soviet Union basically after World War II. So at the moment, the only country really in the post-Soviet space that is actively seeking, well, both European Union membership and NATO membership is Georgia, even under the new government after Mr. Saakashvili left politics. Ukraine has not said it's interested in joining NATO. During the Bush administration, I think there were people in the White House who wanted NATO membership for Ukraine more than the Ukrainians did. They've always been divided on this, and the new interim prime minister has also said, you know, we're not interested in seeking NATO membership. They understand that NATO really is a red flag for Russia. NATO was still the number one enemy in all of the Russian foreign policy and military doctrines. What the Ukrainians would like would be a perspective of EU membership, but they've never been promised that. I mean, even the agreements that were supposed to be signed last fall between Ukraine and the European Union would give them a free trade agreement and an association agreement, but no one was promising the membership. So I think that that's off the cards. The European Union has enough problems of its own, enough economic difficulties. It couldn't take on a country like Ukraine, although one could argue that it would be good for Ukraine to have at least a perspective so that it could undertake necessarily economic reforms. So I think neither of those things are on the table. And if you see some of the things that have been written in the past couple of weeks, both by Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, they've both suggested that a solution moving forward is for Ukraine to say, we're not interested in NATO membership, we're not going to change that, and to have a relationship with the European Union, but one that's compatible with also maintaining a relationship with Russia.
My guest is Angela E. Stent. Her book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, published by Princeton University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why is Ukraine in such financial difficulty? It looks like it's in worse shape than even Greece.
Oh, yes, much worse. The problem with Ukraine, and of course this is where the issue started, is that in the past 22 years, Ukraine has really been unable to establish sort of a functioning, effective, transparent government. It's had a series of governments that have been more or less corrupt, the last one being much more corrupt, a system run by kind of sort of crony capitalism, oligarchs who are tied to the leadership, money disappears down a sieve, nobody knows where it is. And that's why it's in such bad shape. At one point, a few, you know, maybe 6-7 years ago, the Ukrainian economy was actually doing quite well. It's excessively dependent on Russian energy supplies. It has an extremely inefficient energy sector. Again, its energy sector is kind of non-transparent. There's a lot of corruption there. So, and yet Ukraine has, you know, the Black Earth region. It's got fantastic agricultural land. It's got a lot of potential. But it has never undertaken the kind kind of the tough reforms and introducing rule of law and transparency that it needs to do if it wants to move forward economically.
Now, there have been accusations of hypocrisy on both sides. Peter Baker pointed out in the Sunday New York Times that Russia strongly opposed the U.S. decision in 1999 to use military force to help Kosovo secede from Serbia. Russia said the U.S. action was infringing on Serbia's sovereignty. Looks kind of similar to the situation here. On the other hand, the United States invaded Iraq, and Iraq is much further away from our borders than Crimea is from Russia.
Well, the problem is you can throw around all of these analogies all the time. And certainly one thing, when one meets with President Putin, he has a lot of analogies up his sleeve, and he's always using them for lots of different conflicts. There are differences between all of these, and I think what one has to remember is what you're looking at now is a country that, yes, experienced a revolution and where an elected leader fled, again, under circumstances that really aren't very clear. And you had Russian troops anyway in Crimea because they have a naval base. But suddenly this infusion of troops and arbitrarily saying that the next week there was going to be a referendum. I mean, just to go back to Kosovo for a moment. In the end, you know, first of all, the bombing of Serbia was done because there was an imminent threat of much more ethnic cleansing and violent civil war, right? And, you know, there's no threat. I mean, the threat of civil war in Ukraine has now been created by the specter of people in the East egged on by Russians saying that they, you know, that they want to be free of Ukraine. And secondly, in the Kosovo case, before Kosovo gained independence, there was a long period of negotiation where the U.S. and the Europeans tried to get the Russians to agree to a final settlement. Okay, the Russians didn't. But there was an attempt at least to negotiate. This is everything in Ukraine has been done kind of preemptively. So, of course, you can argue about the constitutionality of different actions or what the U.S. did in Iraq. But I think what one has to focus in on is what's happening now and, you know, the imminent danger of a civil war in Ukraine.
You focus your book on four attempts that have been made to reset the diplomatic relationship between the United States and Russia over the last 22 years. All of those resets will launch with great optimism and enthusiasm, only to end in disappointment and disillusionment for both sides. And now we're seeing, at least from some members of the U.S. Congress, the kind of talk that we heard before the fall of the Soviet Union. So is anything all that different? Are we back in the Cold War?
Things are different. We're not ideological antagonists in the way that we were during the Cold War, and we're not trying to carve up the world between, you know, communism and capitalism. We do not have our nuclear weapons targeted at each other. Now, of course, that could change, but at the moment we don't. We don't anticipate that this is going to be a fight till the end with, you know, an enemy. And the third difference, and this makes it more complicated, is Russia is now part of the global economy. When the Soviet Union, you know, invaded Czechoslovakia or Afghanistan, there were no economic repercussions for Russia. Now it's different. It's part of the global economy. And you've already seen an impact of the actions in Crimea on the Russian stock market, on the value of the ruble. However, that also means that, you know, there are a lot of Western economic interests in Russia, particularly European, but some Americans too. So when we talk about sanctions, which, of course, people talked about during the Cold War too, it's different because, you know, the Western side would be quite hurt, too. So some people say we don't have mutually assured destruction anymore in terms of nuclear weapons, but it's almost like a mutually assured containment economically because we're both more dependent on each other now. The rhetoric certainly feels as if we're back in the Cold War days. And then, you know, some of the accusations certainly that the Republicans have made against President Obama, you know, if only he'd been tough, Putin wouldn't have done this. I mean, you can go back to things that happened in the Cold War and similar accusations. So it does have a feel a little bit of the Cold War, but it's not the Cold War. And I think there are enough areas where we have been working with Russia, Iran, you know, where we still will work with them trying to get an agreement. Syria, however complicated, we need to work together. The exit from Afghanistan and what's going to happen in that neighborhood, again, we're working with the Russians. And then other issues like the Arctic, climate change. I mean, they don't grab the press's attention that much, but there are other areas where we have and must work together. So I think the trick is to ensure that this current crisis doesn't destroy all of those other sort of mechanisms of partnership, difficult and frayed as they may be. We're not going to sink back into a Cold War, but I think we'll be in a very difficult relationship with Russia. Certainly this Obama reset is over for the rest of the Obama administration.
Is part of the problem that Russia felt that it was an equal to the United States as a rival during the Cold War, and ever since the fall of the Soviet Union, the respect for it has been diminished considerably?
I think that's a huge part of the problem. I quoted in my book a Russian colleague saying what Putin wanted after supporting President Bush after the 9/11 attacks was an equal partnership of unequals. In other words, Russia has felt that for the past 22 years we have been disrespectful of it. We haven't understood that it has its own interests, and that even though it's economically and militarily weaker than it was before, it is still a great power. It's still a nuclear superpower. It has interests, and we haven't tried to understand those interests and respect those interests. And I think that's what you're seeing. There's almost a furious reaction to what happened in Ukraine as being the ultimate inability and unwillingness of the U.S. to understand Russia's legitimate interests in this part of the world.
On the other hand, the mortality rate for young people in Russia is below sub-Saharan Africa. So this is a troubled country, but we can't get into that. Angela Stent, her book, The Limits of Partnership, U.S.-Russian Relations in the 21st Century, published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great to be on your show.